We are fascinated by dinosaurs. The fascination is probably enhanced by the fact that we never had to live with the giant reptiles. They occupied the Earth a long time ago, and a big chunk of rock hitting the planet had a lot to do with all the dinosaurs going extinct. That is the most dramatic of the mass extinctions we know about in the Earth's history, but not the only one. There have been 5 mass extinctions, and our guest this hour considers whether we're on the brink of number 6. Michael Hanna is the author of Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. Michael is an associate professor in the School of Geography, Environment, and Earth Sciences at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. His expertise is in paleontology and dating rocks using fossils. He joins us from New Zealand, and yes, it is the middle of the night after 4 a.m. Michael, thanks for the black coffee and for joining us on The Exchange.
You're welcome, and it is indeed black coffee.
All right. I say New Zealand because I have not yet pronounced the indigenous name. Would you introduce that to us?
Aotearoa.
Aotearoa. Okay, it is like it looks. Okay, thanks for that. So now, the subtitle of the book, does margin of error indicate that we are that close to being able to say that we are in an extinction event?
The subtitle is really to do more with the number of species we have on the planet today compared to the number of species we've had through the entire 3.7 billion years of life's history. One of the problems we face is we don't know how many species there are on this planet. And the estimates put a margin of error of about 15%, at least the one I use in the book. And when you look back through time, that entire 8.2 million species that we see today is only a fraction of what we could see if we could count up every species that ever existed. So we exist within that margin of error today. So it doesn't really refer to mass extinctions, although they've clearly played a terribly important part in the whole history of life on Earth.
Well, and to that point, I mean, evolution is often described and thought of as gradual change, generation to generation, but the history of life on the planet overall is quite a bit more turbulent than that from the way you write it up.
Yeah, it is, and as I think I say in the book, I mean, all of the paleontologists who have spent so much time and effort trying to document the ups and downs of life, and when you look back on it, there are 5 big mass extinctions. They've been documented well, but they're not the only ones. There has been, depending on how you define a mass extinction, up to about 19 crashes in biodiversity through time. And each one of those affects both the makeup of the planet's biota, what constitute, what species are alive, and it's controlled the level of biodiversity on the planet. So they are important in some senses to the history of life on Earth. We would not have the same biota today if it hadn't been for all the mass extinctions in the past.
How much
to say they are good things.
Mm-hmm. All right. So how much can we know about life long gone, given that not everything leaves fossils? I mean, the fossil record is skewed a bit towards certain kinds of creatures, isn't it?
It is. The way I look at the fossil records, biased in the sense that they're only they're dominated by marine fossils because they're easier to preserve, and it's dominated by fossils with hard parts because they're easier to preserve. But it's biased in a very predictable way. We know about the bias. It's not as if it's going to be random, and we can these estimates always are generally preceded with the marine fossils say, I think now they're very careful about saying, 96% of species died out at the end of the Permian, when they really mean 96% of marine species died out of the Permian. So yes, it is biased, but yes, we know about it, and we can work around that.
And what do you think future geologists, paleontologists will find in the record of the Anthropocene?
It's a good one. I think as they document the fossils going over the boundary from what's now the Holocene into the Anthropocene, we'll see a change. We'll see a change from huge biodiversity, lots of different animals, particularly on ones that we get from land, to ones that are, there may be lots of them, but they'll be much more limited in their diversity. There will be much more, you know, domesticated animals will dominate the fossil record because they're dominantly what is on the life today. So there will be shifts in the record. There'll be changes to the geochemistry of the planet as we add more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. There'll be evidence of massive clearing of land as we make way for our cities and agriculture. So there'll be lots of changes that they can document across there.
Speaking
and of course, the big one is the. Sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you can go ahead.
All right. I was going to talk about the Anthropocene generally and the fact that I noticed that Microsoft Word capitalizes the term now. Has it become the official name for our epoch in history? Has it been decided by scientists yet?
It's been recommended. I'm not aware of it actually being formally adopted. Last I heard, and it's a few months ago now, but it was still discussing where to put the boundary. And they will need to find a place in time where they say, this is where the Anthropocene starts. The original thought was that perhaps it could. What they need is a record that would be available worldwide, that a geologist of the future could come along and say, this is where it started because I'm finding this in the record. And the current feeling is they'll put it somewhere in the early to mid 1950s, when just after the First World War, we had the Great Acceleration and you've got huge increase in industrial. Signals in the record, and also you pick up much more radioactivity from atomic testing. So, as far as I'm aware, they haven't said, right, this is it. But it's probably going to be sometime in the early 1950s.
Okay. All right. So now we know when the starting point is. And boy, we're just going on from there. Michael Hanna, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book is Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. We'll walk up to the question of whether this is, in fact, the sixth mass extinction on the planet Earth when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Hanna and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about extinction on the planet Earth. There have been mass extinctions 5 times in the past. You will hear people who have said on this program in the past, they think this is number 6. We have somebody who's got a lot of background to be able to say definitively whether or not we have gotten to that point yet. Michael Hanna teaches at the School of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, Aotearoa. And he is here to talk about his book, Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error, in which he looks back to what's happened so far and to where we are right now and what that indicates for the future. You can join the conversation, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the term defaunation I had not seen before your book. Is it what it sounds like, the end of a lot of animals anyway?
Term I like rather than the sixth extinction. And the reason is when you look at what's currently happening to the planet, the level of extinctions are significant. The rate of extinction are going up. But the number of species going extinct hasn't reached the levels of say, one of the big 5 mass extinctions, the one at the end of the Cretaceous, which was about 76% species extinction in marine fossils. And I think we can hide behind that number. We can say, well, it's not important because we've only lost 2, 3, 4% of these species. But when you add to it this number of species that are threatened with extinction, then you see a fuller picture of what's really the problems we're facing. And that combination of what's gone extinct and what's teetering on the edge of extinction is what's called deformation. And it's not my term. It's been suggested by a number of biologists. And I think it's a much more inclusive term for the situation we're finding ourselves in today, where we are certainly increasing the rate of extinction. Numbers of species going extinct, a frightening large number, but they're still not at the level of one of the ancient mass extinctions. But when you add that threatened species to it, then yes, we lift up towards that level. So we can't afford to let those threatened species go extinct. Otherwise, we will be well and truly into a mass extinction.
Michael, defaunation does include plants too, though, right? It's not just about animals disappearing.
It does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It does. I've searched long and hard for a better term that includes the sort of animals and plants. We are talking about the entire planet's biota, not just the fossils, not
right.
just the animals.
All right, so that's the situation we're looking at now. Not up to the point of a mass extinction yet, but obviously a lot of creatures who are endangered and threatened. Let's go back to happier times 550 million years ago, and you write that all hell broke loose. What happened back at that time?
That's called the Cambrian Explosion. For 3.5 billion years, life was a single-celled organism, lots of them, but the single-celled. And then somewhere about 600 million years ago, complex animals appeared in the record, and they're some of the most beautiful fossils I've ever seen. They're the things called the Ediacaran fauna from South Australia originally, but then it's now global. They're beautiful. And they're in large numbers. And they go right up to about 550 million years ago, and then quite suddenly in the record, quite large numbers of enormous, huge increase in diversity of different types. Lots of different body plans appear, and you've got some fantastic records of these. It's called the Cambrian Explosion. It's a bit of a misnomer because it doesn't happen overnight. It's sort of 20, 30 million year process, but it's still an enormous increase in diversity. And it's really important for the planet, and it's about that time. It allows what's referred to as the system to really kick into gear and start operating, which maintains the planet and maintains the planet's climate in some sort of equilibrium, and it also increases the ability of the planet.
So,
amazing section.
So it raises the question, for me anyway, whether in fact the planet is sort of built for a boom and bust kind of cycle.
It's a good question. I'd have to say it's built for it, but it certainly has adapted to a boom and bust cycle through time. And as I said, somewhere between 5 and 19 mass extinctions of some sort or other, and it's both come and gone, and life has made it through each time. And it's becoming more habitable because of the way life interacts with the other parts of the Earth system. It's not the simple story that I guess I learned when I was a kid, that this sort of life evolved and gradually got more complicated and complicated and complicated, and everything is sweetness and light until we get back to today. It's a much more ups and down, much more roller coaster ride it's taken through time.
And as you point out in the book, though, it's not just a matter of the conditions being right for certain creatures, but the presence of those creatures also affects the conditions. So this gets us into an Earth system. Give us a sketch of that, if you would, Michael.
Yeah. The Earth system is, I think, an enormously powerful tool. It's a way of looking at the planet and understanding it. It's seen all the separate parts, like the Earth, the solid ground beneath your feet, the atmosphere, the waters, and the life as being integrated. And it sounds a lot like Lovelock's Gaia, and it almost certainly had its originated with this idea of a coherent system that maintains the planet's climate in some sort of equilibrium. life is not a passive player in that. Life changes the rest of the environment. And I think that the example I use in the book is the evolution of animals that can produce oxygen. They didn't just evolve nicely into an atmosphere that was ready for them with lots of oxygen. They produced it, and it was the evolution of different forms that allowed oxygen to not only appear in the atmosphere, but to be maintained at a level that becomes increasingly useful for complicated animals. It's an amazingly powerful idea. And through the glue that holds together all the bits and pieces of my book is this idea that there's a system out there, the mechanics that is maintaining the planet, and we can't afford to disturb it. And it maintains the planet's climate in an equilibrium point. And if you force it, if you disturb it, particularly for a long period of time, it will trigger a shift in that equilibrium to, say, a much warmer condition. And that shift in equilibrium is generally accompanied by a mass extinction. The one I like using is the biggest mass extinction, which happened about 250 million years ago at the end of the Permian, where about 96% of marine animals went extinct. And I've seen estimates of up to about 70-80% of land animals. And it wasn't a pleasant place to start with. It was pretty warm, and carbon dioxide levels were very high. But at the same time, we have this massive volcanic eruption in Siberia, what's now Siberia, and that pushed carbon dioxide levels up enormously. Temperature rose, the oceans became anoxic, the oceans became acidic, and that pushed the Earth system out of equilibrium. The Earth system and the biosphere collapses, we have a mass extinction, and it takes, in the case of some mass extinctions, millions of years to recover from that those sort of events. So we can look at the Permian mass extinction and see the changes I was talking about with increased carbon dioxide and ocean acidification, ocean lack of oxygen. And you could apply them today. I mean, we are increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere enormously. We are causing the oceans to go acidic. We are causing the oceans to go anoxic. But the big difference is, in the Permian case, it was a massive volcanic eruption that's driving it. And here it's our burning of fossil fuels that are largely driving that forcing on the Earth system. We can't afford to let the Earth system flip into another equilibrium point, because that would then allow us to continue our slide into the sixth mass extinction.
Michael Hanna is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an associate professor at the Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, Aotearoa. Yes, he is joining us in the middle of the night between 4 and 5 a.m. Wednesday to talk to us about his book, Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. You're welcome to join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we explore the five great mass extinctions that have happened already on Earth and the possibility that we are approaching number six. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So life does return after mass extinctions, but how slowly and how different, Michael, from what was around before?
It's slow. At the end of the Permian, the one I was just talking about, all the coral reefs are completely wiped out, and we don't see another coral reef on the planet for another 20 million years. There's some really neat recovery sections, so ones where we document the recovery coming out of, say, the big mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, where the dinosaurs died out, and you can see the system recovering as each of the fluxes which transfer energy and matter around the system kick into gear as the biosphere recovers. They're calling it Earth system recovery, and it operates just like you've got those massive forest fires going through your area now, and when they die away, life will come back. There will be a system, a series of recoveries. Then the pioneer plants will arrive, and then they will allow other parts of the biota to come back in on stream. And the same thing can be seen in the fossil record. You can at the end of the Cretaceous in New Zealand, there is a area on the west coast of the South Island that you can document at the end of the Cretaceous, or the complicated biodiverse flora beforehand dies out, and then all you're left with are ferns. And then as you go through time, that flora is re-established and different plants arrive, and finally where flowering plants arrive at the end. So it restores the diversity of the biota. But when you go into mass extinction, you don't know what's going to come out at the other end of it. There is no easy way of predicting which species are likely to survive a mass extinction, which aren't. Now, if I was a time-traveling paleontologist and I went back just before the dinosaurs died out, I picked that the little mammals fluttering around at its feet would be the dominant life form on the planet, or would I think the dinosaurs would live forever? I suspect I wouldn't pay much attention to the mammals. I'd be too enamored by looking at these huge dinosaurs. It's very difficult to pick what will come out of a mass extinction. So, you know, we are playing dice with our fauna now.
Well, then that brings up a question that, and I think the expression you use in the book is the idea that we can ride it out, you know, in the sense that, you know, because life does come back. I mean, that is a bit of a roll of the dice, isn't it, to think that you know, we'll be okay ultimately. Things will balance out.
Yeah, it is a dice, and this is where the Earth system comes in. For the Earth system to operate, you need a complicated, biodiverse ecology. The ecosystem has to be well and truly functioning. If you try and manage our way through a mass extinction, and you could do it, let's have, you know, lots of, let's plant lots of pine trees, let's have lots of domesticated animals, you won't have that biodiversity at the other end, so your system is not going to operate at its optimal level. So you probably could do it, but I'm not sure what sort of a planet would remain at the end of it. And as I think I also say in the book, it sounds more sort of like a science fiction movie, that, you know, some dystopian future when we're the planet isn't quite working properly.
So the red list of threatened species that you show us in the book, which animals, which groups of animals appear to be taking things the hardest?
Kind of flick through to the table. The Red List is an amazing piece of documentation. They can only document what they can see, of course, so that any animals that we haven't counted up till now, any animals we haven't recognized up till now, we can't decide whether or not they're going extinct. What they have is in the broader sense of the mammals they've looked at. When I wrote this list, this was lifted out of their data some months ago, but I don't think it changed very much since then. If you look at mammals as a whole, they think they've probably assessed 91% of all the animals on the planet, of which about 1.46% have gone extinct already. And the same with birds. Birds are, they've looked at all the species they think that they've recognized on the planet, and they've assessed them, and they reckon there's about 1.47% extinct. But when you get down to amphibians, it's less than 1% extinction. This is what I'm talking about when I talk about defaunation, because now you take those numbers, which are low, you know, under 2%. In fact, the highest is clams, bitties, where 4% are currently extinct. But if you add to it the threatened category, those clams go up to 33% almost. With mammals, it goes from 1.5% almost to 24%. our problem enormously if we see this thing as a deformation event and the beginning of a mass extinction rather than being in the middle of a mass extinction. I think we hide the true scope of the problem by focusing only on the extinctions.
I didn't hear the number when you add the threatened and endangered amphibians in. What does that rocket their number to? Amphibians.
Amphibians are again less than 1% extinction, and they get to about 34% if you include the threatened. But the rate at which they're going extinct, amphibians going extinct, is enormous. Since the appearances of humans on the planet, the rate at which amphibians are going extinct has risen, one estimate suggests, 100%. It's an enormous increase in the rate at which things are going extinct.
We're about a minute away from a break, so this may need to break an answer across that break. But is it anything cyclical here? Movements of continents, Earth, Sun, star system, galaxy, whatever, that accounts for these cycles on the Earth?
I think you're going to go to a break because it's a long one. yes, they've been trying to find cyclicity in extinctions and appearances for a long, long time. It's a bit like whack-a-mole, you know. Someone says there's this level, and events will turn up and say, no, it's not, and another estimate will pop up. There is no evidence for a fact this is in mass extinctions.
All right, we'll leave it at that for the moment. We'll come back with Michael Hanna. His book is Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. We're talking about the previous five and the prospects for a sixth great mass extinction right in front of us. You can join us on The Exchange. We'll come back to the program in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Michael Hanna, Associate Professor in the School of Geography, Environment, and Earth Sciences at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, Aotearoa. His experiences in paleontology and dating rocks using fossils. He has written a book that looks at the five previous mass extinctions on the Earth and the prospects for a sixth. And his book is called Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we get into the defaunation currently underway with so many species dying off, both plants and animals at the same time. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So to sum up what we started on, Michael, it sounds like there's no cycle that would account for every X number of years there's going to be a mass extinction.
When the Big Five were first recognized back in the mid-80s, they did the job, a fantastic paleontologist called Jack Sapkowski and Dave Grubb. They thought they found an extinction rate of about 23 million years. Every 22 million years, there would be a mass extinction. And they tried to work out what could drive that sort of cyclicity. And they, about the same time, the idea that a meteorite caused the extinctions of the dinosaurs came in. So everyone started looking at some sort of celestial driver for these mass extinctions. What came up was this planet called Nemesis. So I wish they'd never called it Nemesis, because it really did raise a lot of eyebrows.
Scary sound.
And the idea was this planet somehow cycles through a thing called the Oort cloud, which is somewhere out in the depths of space, and sends millions of comets and meteorites plunging towards the solar system, and that drove the mass extinctions. Problems came up. First of all, there's no indication that 23 million years anymore. That seems to be a quirk of dating. And the only mass extinction that is tied to a meteorite impact is the one at the end of the dinosaurs. Every other one is tied to something else, usually a big volcanic eruption. And even the one at the end of the Cretaceous where the dinosaurs died out, it's not just the meteorite. At the same time, there is a massive volcanic eruption in India called the Deccan Traps. And together, they occur at exactly the same time. So it's not just the meteorite, I don't think. There's a couple of other things involved there, too.
Let's take a phone call.
I've written the book. Sorry?
Go ahead. Since you've written the book?
Since I've written the book, another cyclicity has been suggested. A 62 million year cyclicity, not to extinctions, but to bursts of diversity increases. I haven't followed up yet exactly what would be driving that one.
Oh, okay. We'll have to have you back to talk about that one down the road. Stephen Grants Pass is on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Hanna, the author of Extinctions. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you. Michael, I was curious, you mentioned the ocean acidity and everything, and you mentioned coral. I was wondering if there are other organisms at the bottom of the food chain that you are specifically monitoring as a metric that would affect everything above that food chain. I don't know, krill or whatever, that you are really monitoring for extinction.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve.
There is. One of the most important organisms in the ocean for absorbing carbon dioxide and locking it away so that it doesn't accumulate either in the oceans or the atmosphere, a little tiny algae called Coccolithophius. And they make little calcium carbonate shells, tiny, tiny little things, and that they form blooms, and they will take a lot of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And when they die, their shells fall to the bottom of the oceans and are locked away as limestone, taking that carbon dioxide nicely out of the system. And there's been suggestions we could encourage the growth of these things by adding iron to the oceans, but I'm not sure that's worked terribly well. But at the end of the Permian, they didn't exist. They hadn't evolved, so that one of the reasons that the carbon dioxide levels there were so high. I don't know how much monitoring is going on of those fossils, of those living organisms, but I know there are lots of people who track in detail these what's happening to these things through time.
Paul on Sterling Creek asks if there's ever been a mass extinction that we know of triggered by a pandemic like COVID-19.
Not that I'm aware of. There's been some amazing suggestions for what killed the dinosaurs, and one of them was some sort of pandemic that killed off all the dinosaurs. But there's no real evidence for that at all. And it would also be really hard to find that sort of evidence in the fossil record. It's not the sort of thing that gets preserved as a fossil. All you'd see is the crisis dying out, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So how long after the impact and the mass die-off at the end of the Cretaceous then, how long before species somewhat like humans developed?
That's a good question. I think you push human ape split is about, if I remember rightly, 6 or 7 million years ago. And that's when the lineage that leads up to us split away from the common ancestor with the apes. 6 or 7 million years, and the dinosaurs died out 65 million years. So it's been a long time coming.
Mm. To the point of the creatures that show up when there has been a mass extinction, I mean, are there some species that crop up for a short while, then evolve into something else or die out themselves? I mean, are there stepping stone species? Does the fossil record indicate anything like that?
In terms of yes, there are. In the terms of plants, I've already said that particularly after the Cretaceous, that the first thing we find are lots of ferns.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see the other plants coming in after that. The other section I talk about in some detail is one, I think it's in Colorado, and you can see vertebrate fossils coming in and developing alongside as different plant species appear, different vertebrate fossils appear to take advantage of those plants as they go through time. But I don't, as I said, there's no way of predicting up front what will survive mass extinction.
Mm.
It's the best you could do if we slid into mass extinction now, the best we could do is go to the red list beforehand and see which is the most threatened species. At least then we could predict what more likely to be extinct. But what happens at the other end is a lottery.
So, Michael, let's talk about the human influence in megafauna extinctions, the big critters around. I mean, is it a fairly straightforward thing? I know, having talked to some other people over the years about, you know, why did elephants survive and mastodons and mammoths did not? And the answer I got from one scientist was, well, because humans actually grew up with elephants where they didn't in the other cases. Is it that simple? Is there a great source of debate in science over how much of a hand humans have had in the disappearance of megafauna?
It's a huge debate, and you get the feeling, this is not this is very young for me. My paleontology is normally a bit older stuff, so I've had to really delve into the debate to try and follow what's going on. There used to be only two models for the what's called the megafauna. Megafauna are the big animals. We see today's African animals are the megafauna still exists, but elsewhere there was, as you say, mammoths, mastodon, direwolves, and in Australia, where I come from, there was 7 meter lizards and 3 meter kangaroos and all sorts of stuff, and they all died out sometime between about 40,000 and 12,000 years ago. There is indication that mammoths got a bit younger than that. And trying to find out a single reason for that is almost impossible. There used to be two. One was that the climate did it because we're coming out of the ice ages and we're going through quite a bit of turmoil as we did that, and maybe that drove them to extinction. Or humans coming out of Africa with the latest of sort of Stone Age technology wiped them out. And the reason they survived in Africa is that they are naive, is the word they use, that they grew up alongside newly evolved humans, so they used to be able to avoid them. But once humans moved out of Africa into areas that these megafauna hadn't seen humans before, they were fairly easy to kill off. There's now a third model, and that was due to an impact that a massive shower of cometary debris hits the planet and triggers the die-off. There's no clear answer, in my opinion, to say what is what causes extinctions, be it humans or climate. I will take bets now that ultimately will turn out to be some sort of combination of the two, and which one's more important will depend where you are on the planet. The Australian extinctions are almost certainly due to a combination, dominantly by climate and with the humans, whereas in North America, it looks more likely that humans had more to do with it than climate. It's a very complicated situation. I don't, as I said, I had to wade through a lot of literature, and you get the feeling that these groups are talking past each other at times rather than really coming to grips with the problem, but maybe I'm being a bit unkind to my fellow scientists.
Let me come back to a point that you make early in the book and a fair number of times thereafter. I mean, how much, as we talk about the things that are disappearing, how much do we actually know about the species that do occupy the planet now?
Not enough. The people who've read the book have come up with generally they like it, which is good. But one of the comments they make is, you know, well, you tell us that we have a problem, we haven't got much time to fix it. What do you do? How do you fix it? And my reply, in the first instance, is let's find out how much biodiversity we have on the planet because we don't know. I use an estimate of 8.7 million species on the planet with an error bar of 15%, but that's just one estimate among many, and they vary wildly, but most of it's around 10 million. We don't know that, and to me that's such a fundamental piece of data that we need to know before we can really come to grips. We need to know what our biodiversity is before we can decide how bad the situation really is that we're dealing with. So my first job, if I could, you know, start healing the planet, is let's understand the biodiversity on the planet up front. Second one would be we need to sort of really pull back on those emissions to get climate change under control, and then move on to looking at rehabilitation of our land.
So biodiversity, emissions, and then rehab. And then with the trend lines as they are, I mean, you say, no, this is a defaunation, but not the sixth mass extinction. The word yet is always hanging in my head, whether or not it's in yours. Is the trend line showing that we'll get to a sixth mass extinction if we continue business as usual?
Yes, it does. Business as usual, there's a very broad estimate, right? And this also goes to the heart of let's do something about it. There's a very broad estimate that if we allow business as usual, we have about 270 years before we reach a 75% extinction rate, which is about the level of the mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous. If we do something about it and ameliorate that rate of extinction, so we pull back on those extinction rates, that goes out to at least 2,000. So, they're rough numbers and they're based only on vertebrate fossils. You're really vague, but it tells you the direction. We do not have a lot of time before we hit the level of one of these old mass extinctions. But if we do something about it and we start making the changes we need to make, then yes, we're going to have some time. And we really do need to do that.
All right, we've certainly got to understand the five mass extinctions that have happened already and get some ideas on how to forestall a sixth in the book, Extinctions, Living and Dying in the Margin of Error. Michael Hanna is the author of the book and associate professor in the School of Geography, Environment, and Earth Sciences at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. Michael, thank you so much for getting up in the middle of the night to talk to us about this.
Thank you.